what does explain why this film has been so discussed and so like talked about, because it doesn't seem to be its artistic merits. It, you know, straightforwardly gives people the chance to talk about what they wanted to talk about anyway, which is Israel-Palestine. This is obviously not a film about Israel-Palestine. It's a film about a related matter, you might put it, but obviously everybody has interpreted it through that lens, leading to, yeah, I think, Alex, you're probably about right. A lot of culture wars, people talking past each other or just, you know, not really wanting to have a conversation.
I think, I mean, I would go a bit further, I think, in that it's also possible to, you know, to write off any hotly contested dispute, particularly in the realm of culture or cultural kind of debates that are adjacent to political issues of the day, to write it off as culture wars because, you know, it's all heat and no light. And I think it's a bit more than that in this case, because I think what's happening is it marks a moment when Israel can no longer legitimate itself by reference to the suffering of the Holocaust. And that's significant, I think. And Jonathan Glazer standing up there and saying what he did and claiming, you know, that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide, with the authority of somebody who's been awarded an Oscar for a film which is about the genocide of the Jews, that seems to me to be an important shift. As well as the fact that this film, like I say, is a shift away from inviting the viewer to see the film from the viewpoint of the victims, instead to see it from the viewpoint of the perpetrators in a very specific context, you know, kind of senior ranking administrators rather than the people involved in face-to-face killing.
Hello, welcome everyone to BungaCast. I'm Alex Oculi in São Paulo, Brazil, and today we are also George Hoare in London and Philip Cunliffe in Canterbury. Hello, boys.
Hey,
also,
how you doing?
Also, I think you mean always or almost always.
Mm. We are good. We are surviving after Jurgen Klopp has left Liverpool, so we are reduced in spirit, but we are not podcasting alone. We never... Mm. We'll have to again.
Never, never podcast alone. That would be weird. We are here to talk about a film.
Wait. We should say there is no podcast view on football, right? BungaCast does not support Liverpool, even if 2 out of 3 of the main podcast hosts support Liverpool. So just for the record.
Yeah, there is no line, obviously, on that, though we will be back with some football episodes, which Phil won't be there for. He just gets marginalized for that sort of content. Anyway, I say we are because it's the 3 original Bunga Boys, but this podcast now is also, well, we have these new contributors who be joining us regularly: Alex Gurevich, Catherine Liu, Amber Ali Frost, and Lee Phillips. They're going to be participating increasingly as they kind of come on board over the next period, particularly Lee and Alex, who were meant to be only joining kind of in the middle of the year. So that's to look forward to. I'm doing this every time. Apologies if it bores you, if you've heard this, but to let you know about the new BungaCast, we release new episodes every Tuesday. So you're hearing this potentially on a Tuesday. And that is irrespective of whether it's a free episode or behind a paywall. But we also put out episodes occasionally, every other week or so, on Thursdays or Fridays. And you can find those at patreon.com/BungaCast. You will maybe know that we put out 2 free episodes a month. All the rest of it is going to be, or at least the full episode, is going to be paywalled at Patreon. So we hope you'll join us over there for that. That includes episodes with the contributors who I've already mentioned. It includes episodes with authors and editors of Damage Magazine with whom we're now partnered. We've already done a couple of those. We had Christy and Ben on to talk about Size Queen Nation, about the penis enhancement and penis anxiety industry. We're also going to have Sam Chris, who's on the editorial board, on very soon to talk, well, about a whole range of things, including Saudi modernism, but plenty else besides. And so if you're joining us on patreon.com/bungacats, you get at least 4 original episodes a month that you can't get elsewhere, and a free subscription to Damage Magazine. Now, I know lots of you have been with us for a long time, and we're hugely appreciative of that, but I should mention that those tiers that you're on, the $5 and $10 tiers, have now been unpublished. They're not visible to anyone, and they're going to be phased out. We're still servicing you with content on that, so the kind of 2 episodes you used to get a month, new subscribers can't sign up to that, and we're going to gradually phase those out. So if you'd like to continue receiving BungaCast content, and indeed have double what you're currently getting for only $2 more a month than you were paying previously, that can be done by joining the Unholy Alliance or the Grand Corruption tier, the latter also giving you access to the Reading Club. So that's all very exciting. We're having the next Reading Club is on a book about the structure of contemporary Russian politics or post-Soviet politics. And we are also doing one about Julien Banda's Treason of the Clerks. So that's very exciting. I'll be introducing those works in a couple of months. All right. So let's get cracking. This is a film episode. We've recently done Civil War. I really enjoyed that episode. I think we all enjoyed discussing it quite a lot. There was a lot to get into.
We did, despite being a kind of a so-so movie. It was a very good discussion, I think.
I think I would say it is slightly better than a so-so movie. Maybe a so-so-so. 3 so's out of 5.
3 so's out of 5. I think that's right. 3 so's out of 5. Maybe even 3.5. I enjoyed it.
No, 2.5 stars out of 5. Well,
listeners can go check out that episode to figure out what we thought about it. But we are now doing another film, actually, in this one, where it's not one that's just come out, but it's kind of has been maybe the most talked about film of the year for a number of reasons. It is Zone of Interest by Jonathan Glazer, which came out at the very end of last year, I believe, and it won the Oscar for Best Picture. The acceptance speech, I'm sure you know this already, the acceptance speech caused a bit of a stir because Jonathan Glazer called out the ongoing war in, called out, that's a ridiculous way to say it, but we will get on to that and maybe some of the precise phrasing that went along with that, but, you know, was critical of the war, both the 7th of October attacks and the Israel's retaliation against Hamas and the Palestinian residents of Gaza. So,
yeah. Sorry, Alex. I think you said it won the Best Picture Oscar. I know we are a global politics podcast, but it was the best international film. We still have to pay due reverence to our American overlords, and their Best Picture was the single Best Picture. But this was the rest of the world. It's like the Best Picture for the majority of the world.
So. I mean, he's a British director, so I thought, you know, it's a British colony, you know, it's part of the United States, effectively. So anyway, yeah. We'll get on to, I think, Jonathan Glazer's comments where he quote unquote refuted his Jewishness being used to support Israel's policies, which is there's kind of some misphrasing there. Anyway, I wanted to ask you guys, have you seen any of his previous films? Because he hasn't done a lot of work. He hasn't done a lot of feature films. He's done a lot of adverts, actually, which I wasn't aware of. And let me just go over the 3 previous features that he's done, that he's directed. Sexy Beast from 2000, Birth from 2004, and Under the Skin from 2013. Have you seen any of these?
No, but I have seen his probably most iconic work, which is he directed the Guinness Surfer advert. For those who are remember this is a very powerful bit of, I would even say, cinema. I think I saw this this advert in the cinema. But no, the only thing I have to say about him is that, you know, his name's Jonathan Glazer, and maybe he makes windows into the soul through his films. So
That's tenuous.
That is a 4 so's out of 5 joke.
Less of that as we go forward, Phil.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a joke in response to George's stupid Glazer point, but I realized that anything I say at this point would come across as a bad Holocaust joke. But that aside, I have seen Sexy Beast, and I have seen Under the Skin. I've not seen Birth. you know, Sexy Beast is the famous character with Ben Kingsley as the villain. A very, very famous performance, and made it into The Sopranos as well, as kind of part of the plot of The Sopranos, in one of the episodes when Christopher Moltisanti goes to Hollywood. And Under the Skin is a very good movie. In fact, it's a kind of a strange science fiction horror movie. Those are the ones I've seen. I didn't really have any expectations off the back of having seen them for what Zone of Interest might be like. I don't think any of them are great movies. And so I guess that is a preface to what I'll say about Zone of Interest in due course.
So, I mean, I imagine lots of the people listening to this will have already seen the film, especially if you've chosen to listen to this episode. But maybe you haven't, and you're interested in this and what we have to say because it touches on so many contemporary issues. So I'm going to recap a little bit, you know, just the kind of basic idea of the film. But I want to say just before that, you know, in reference to Under the Skin, that film works so, builds a sort of soundstage, which is phenomenal. And the soundtrack and the scoring and the kind of sound effects are really impressive in that film. And it's also shiny, you know, it's a very kind of sexy, shiny film, which alternates between kind of beautiful pictures of the Scottish Highlands and kind of inner city Glasgow. And this film as well, I think, works along, or, you know, succeeds in similar terrain. I think we'll agree, at least that sonorically, it's a very attractive and captivating film.
Sonorically, that's
disagree.
That's not necessarily how I would put it, but we can get onto that. I'm sure. I don't think we'll agree on this one, actually.
Interesting. Right. So the film centers on Rudolf Höss, a high-ranking Nazi, a real person, and he and his family who live just outside the gates of or the walls of Auschwitz. And their daily lives are interrupted by the sounds from inside the walls, shootings, the roar of the crematorium, etc. Their life is a happy family life. And Rudolf Höss himself occupies himself with bureaucratic activities, meetings about crematorium plans, forced labor. Then he gets promoted to oversee the deportation of 400,000 Hungarian Jews. And the film is also interesting. And so this is a reference to some of those visual and sonoric kind of little bits and tricks that Glazer throws in, is that there are some night vision thermal images of a girl gathering and depositing things, which we don't know what they are really, where forced labor takes place. So it seems that she is leaving a apple for the, you know, Holocaust inmates, and she and that is actually based on a true story. We're going to get onto the relationship to the truth and to the true history, as well as another account of this in just a second. The film follows Hearst's ascent as he gets promoted. He is a very dedicated company man as a Nazi. And the film almost finishes with a flash forward to cleaners coming in to tidy up the modern day Auschwitz Museum, which is another issue which I think we definitely should touch upon. So before we kind of proceed with the film, I think, George, you've written the Martin Amis book called Zone of Interest, which this film is supposedly based on.
Yes, I have. I have read it. It's not really based on it, though. I do appreciate when a director or any kind of artist takes an existing work and is like, "Well, I really like the name of this, or I really like some aspect of it, but I'm basically going to junk everything else." Yeah, I don't think you need to have read this book in order to see the film, certainly.
So it's like a riff on kind of certain aspects?
Well, there are some similarities. So Amis's book is about a German officer in Auschwitz who basically falls in love with the commandant's wife, and then the commandant finds out and gets his wife, or tries to get his wife, killed. It wasn't one of my favorite Martin Amis books when it came out. I didn't really remember much of what happened, but I do remember it came after so it was in 2014, and in 2012 Amis had done this book, Lionel Asbo, State of England, which you can tell from the title, it's not a great one. So I would, as much as I do have a bit of a soft spot for Mart, you know, I don't think this was one of his best, particularly, but it, you know, it was set in Auschwitz. It had, I guess, an element of kind of some of the relationships between the commandant at the camp and his wife. So, but it didn't really I mean, what would a book look like to be adapted faithfully in this film? There isn't really, as we'll get onto, I'm sure, in a lot more detail, there isn't really a plot, and nothing really happens in this film, you could say. And if you had a book like that, you know, I guess you can have some books like that, but Amis is probably not somebody who'd write one like that.
So, I mean, the question of Jewish suffering obviously is front and center. I mean, it is a Holocaust film, and Glazer apparently spent a long time.
It's not front and center. That's the whole point of the movie.
I also think there's a question mark as to whether it is a Holocaust film or not. And this isn't some hot takes, not some kind of contrarian, whatever. But we'll get onto this. But I think there is it is so striking the way that actually what is shown and what is not shown. And I think that's one thing which is, you know, a defining feature of the film.
So that's very interesting. So we have plenty to kind of dig into. Have you guys, I think it's worth putting this in the context of other Holocaust films, even if you disagree with the premise of the question, because it is its own kind of subgenre. We can think of notable examples like La Vita è Bella, Schindler's List, The Pianist. Maybe you want to throw in some others. What are your feelings on some of these that I've mentioned and the kind of genre as a whole? You know, do you think it's successful in what it tries to do?
Well, there's even a sub genre. Jojo Rabbit, I saw described as holla kitsch, which I think is a great it's a great label for what is, I think, an absolutely terrible film with very little to recommend it. I mean, I think Schindler's List is probably the, you know, that's like the standard narrative. Like that's, I mean, it, you know, Spielberg, you've got to have a bit of a soft spot for him, but I think it, you know, was massively successful. You know, that is the kind of, that's the one that is almost the comparison, and certainly was for Spielberg himself when he gave very high praise to Glazer's film, saying it's the best Holocaust film since My Own, which very, very generous of him. But yeah, I think, I mean, it is a subgenre. There's enough there. Then there's many more. And I don't know if you, I had a look through Wikipedia to see all the Holocaust films and the ones that I'd seen. Also Inglourious Basterds was on there. Did you say Marathon Man? The Man with the Iron Heart. These are ones which are maybe a bit, touch on the Holocaust a bit less directly. They're not kind of concentration camp films, but they certainly made the Wikipedia cut.
That's a good point, actually. There's a whole sub-genre, which is concentration camp films. And then there are kind of a whole range of other things which are, you know, outside somehow. You know, it's about deportation, or it's about hiding from the Nazis, or, you know, someone, a good Samaritan hiding Jews in their basement. I can think of several films like that. Phil?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the ones you've mentioned, Alex, Schindler's List and The Pianist. I think The Pianist is a great movie, in fact. And the, you know, I think Schindler's List also is a very good movie, despite I think it's fashionable to kind of hate on it among a certain class of film aficionado. The other one, I think, which is also, I mean, you know, it's, you can say it's a genre, but I mean, also in any, so many kind of, any film which is set roughly in that period about the war in Europe will inevitably kind of make some reference or other to the Holocaust. So I think it's not something which is necessarily contained to Holocaust films. The other one I'd mention, which is very good, and in many ways I think is the one which is, I think, probably the best, in fact, movie of this type that I've seen, is The Edges of the Lord, the 2001 movie with Willem Dafoe and Haley Joel Osment. I think it's by a Turkish director, in fact, or maybe, a Polish director. And it's really an astonishing film, mainly because it's told from the viewpoint of a kid, a Polish kid, whose family's hiding a Jewish boy. Anyway, it's only to say, I mean, this is perhaps already encroaching on the substance of what we wanted to talk about, but I think one significant difference is, and this is important, I think, for the way the film has been received, is the fact that, you know, generally the Holocaust movie, as it's understood at least, is told from the viewpoint of the victims, the Jews, and then maybe with, you know, one or two add-ins, whereas the conceit of this film is to tell the movie from the viewpoint of the Nazis, or at least high-ranking Nazis who aren't involved in the day-to-day meeting out of mass murder in the sense of killing face-to-face. So I think that's an important shift. Yeah, there's, well, senior ranking administrators, bureaucrats, and so on. And I think that's an important shift in terms of how, which I think explains why the film is so popular. And also, I think probably tells us something significant about how attitudes towards the Holocaust are shifting in the context of the Gaza War. I don't want to make, you know, I don't want to hook all of my comments on the discourse around film, because, you know, it's kind of a tedious, can be a tedious move, but I think it is, it's unavoidable in the in this particular instance.
Absolutely. I think it's worth pointing out, though, that Glazer has been working on this film reportedly for a long time. And so it was not provoked into making the film by, you know, recent attacks. I mean, obviously, he wouldn't have been able to turn it around so quickly. I don't know what, you know, I haven't seen if he's talked about what prompted him to specifically deal with the question. But you know, it's not him responding to contemporary events. Obviously, what are you laughing at?
No, sorry, just the way you said. Obviously, he couldn't have turned it around that quick. Yes, that's true. He could not.
Well, you know, just to make sure there's no kind of suggestion that I'm thinking like, well, you know, he's thinking about the war in Gaza, you know, as he makes the film.
No, but he did, obviously, in his acceptance speech, which he earned both kind of praise and, you know, praise and condemnation, I think, in equal measure for saying it. I mean, the reason it's very hard because I don't think it's an especially good movie. And so inevitably then it. But given the fact that it's a movie which has, you know, received plenty of accolades and is talked about widely, inevitably your views about it are colored by the discourse around it, particularly because it, you know, it doesn't have, at least in my view, it doesn't have sufficient artistic merit to stand independently of it. And I think, I mean, it's important because, you know, there are plenty of movies about mass atrocities where it's possible. I mean, it's important because the Holocaust movie sets... it frames the way in which we understand mass atrocities, I think. And it's, you know, it's important that Schindler's List came in the year of American unipolarity. And then subsequently, the movies that came subsequently to that were also framed by that moment. But also movies that aren't about the Holocaust are inevitably shaped by, you know, the legacy and inheritance of films that are about the ultimate, you know, the kind of the ultimate moment of exterminatory mass murder. And so if you think of a movie like Hotel Rwanda, you know, it's very clearly framed. Again, it's told from the viewpoint of the victims. So even movies that are not Holocaust movies, they are told from the viewpoint of the victims, and there's always a stand-in for the suffering of the Jews or, you know, another group that kind of... that is, becomes the Jews in the context of the atrocity that's being depicted, whether it's the massacres in Rwanda or in Bosnia or other films kind of set in the context of Africa. And that's important because this is, like I say, it's a film where it pivots to the viewpoint of the Nazis. And I think that changes the, it implicates the viewer in a very different way, particularly with a film that's so heavy-handed and crude as I think this one is. I mean, I'm really struggling to contain my disdain for the movie. I think it's a real kind of hatchet job of a film, basically. A relentless piece of liberal propaganda.
We should move on to what the film is ostensibly about, though, I think.
Yes, exactly.
I mean,
yeah, no, so this is something which I'm not going to set up as a question. I'm going to put it as a statement because I don't think anyone will deny, or I think it would be inconceivable to have a different interpretation to say that this film is somehow not about the banality of evil, the phrase taken from Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem. So it is very obviously about, you know, the Nazis going about their daily business with this suffering, I mean, untold suffering going on somehow on the other side of the walls, which we are not privy to. So when Phil brought me up, you know, on saying, you know, it puts Jewish suffering front and center, I guess, you know, I guess the point, the trick here is that it very much doesn't. It does kind of the opposite of it. But you know, to be in proper dialectical form, that means that it does. You know, it's like, it's the negation.
Does that mean that
it.
Every film is about everything at all
no,
times?
No, because this is like the diametric opposite. So it says it without, you know, by pointing to its absence. Anyway, I'm going to stop bloviating. The question which I want to ask is whether we think Glazer is successful in his approach to render this theme of the banality of evil. And we can go through across different aspects. We don't have to break this discussion down into kind of be kind of so systematic about it. We can just talk about what we want. But I think in cinematography or sound design, in the characters, in plotting, there are various different ways in which I think he attempts to depict the banality of evil. So thoughts, and also, yeah, you know, if you think there's any other relevant film, you know, which also deals with this, which I can't think of anything which is like, so, hey, this is a banality of evil film.
Sorry, I don't think there is one. No, I don't. I think it is a, it clearly is about the banality of evil. I wouldn't be surprised if Glazer had kind of had that thought either consciously or not at some point in making it, because it does so clearly seem to be about this idea of Hannah Arendt's, which, you know, just to recap, is that the, you know, in large part, the evil of the Holocaust is not the sadism that was contained within it, but the moral universe that reduced human beings, some human beings, to instruments and to objects, and that kind of, you know, that worldview. And I think is the film successful in doing this? Well, to a certain extent, I think it is. But does this actually make it a good film is an entirely different question. So what it does is take this very kind of, there isn't really a plot, as I said before. It's almost a documentary with these kind of cameras up in this, in the house, essentially kind of documenting the lives of the kind of Big Brother house almost. And I guess what the wager is of this film is that this is supposed to be gripping. Like, you're supposed to kind of be presented by the contrast between what you know is happening off the screen and what's happening on the screen, and that is supposed to pull you in as a viewer and to make you feel appalled and like trapped, or somehow it's supposed to grind you down. And I don't think it works on those terms, because I didn't find it gripping from the start. I felt like I was being kind of told to watch an important film with a capital I and a capital F, and I think there could have been a way that this could have been done where that kind of the contrast between the family life and the camp could have been worked through, and it would have drawn me in and I would have felt, you know, rooted to my seat for the whole time. But yeah, it just didn't. I mean, I kind of wanted to have something more positive to say, because you can have boredom in the cinema being a really interesting kind of, because that's another thing, like banality is not necessarily a bad thing to have a film about. Like, you know, all films have to be interesting all the time, and that makes them all in one way kind of look the same. But it made me think of Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void, which is a very boring film but a very good film, and that is very slow paced. The plot doesn't really happen in a linear way. There are all these tracking shots which go on way too long, but it actually draws you in and you care about the characters or more. You just feel like this is a, you know, a film that you want to watch rather than a film you're kind of being compelled to watch. So I can't say anything positive in this particular element.
Yeah, so I mean, my feeling is kind of, my conclusion is similar to George's, but I guess the path is somewhat different. I found it quite watchable, in the sense I didn't find it kind of dull. It was watchable, but you know, certainly not gripping. I thought it was kind of, there were some parts of it that were just unspeakably crude, like, and there's no spoiler alerts here because there's no real plot, as George said, but the you know, there are moments where it kind of intercuts to this at random points in the movie, even when the main character, the commandant Rudolf Voss, is far away from Auschwitz and outside in, you know, back in Berlin or something, and there's these enormous sounds of this kind of this enormous kind of devouring machine-like sound that interrupts the film, and it's such a crude, you know, I mean, it's such a crude device as a way of reminding us that there's this horror in the background, as if the viewer needs to be reminded through this kind of interruption within it. And the other element that I think is there's, again, no spoiler alert at the end, as Alex mentioned, it cuts away to, again, kind of just a documentary style scene of modern day Auschwitz, of the cleaners going into the museum, cleaning the display cases of the glass, hoovering around the carpets and so on, and gives you a few shots of what modern day Auschwitz looks like compared to what it looked like historically. And again, I just think it's so, so crude, but even that isn't the worst part of the film. I think, you know, so the classic Holocaust movie, is it invites you to sympathize with those who are suffering, you know, for better or for worse. The Jews who are being hidden by sympathetic civilians, or occasionally kind of Jews who are fighting back in some partisan films, or people who are in camps or being persecuted in some way. It invites you to sympathize with the suffering of those who are being persecuted for completely irrational and arbitrary reasons. Whereas this doesn't invite you to sympathize, but it takes you to the viewpoint of people enjoying very comfortable lives next to this kind of unimaginable horror, which only occasionally intrudes through the sounds of dogs barking in the camp or gunshots, and then occasionally this kind of artificial, monstrous, mechanical sound of some kind of machine eating something or releasing gas or something like that. And occasionally you get the ash comes over the houses surrounding the camp and they have to bring the washing in or close the windows or something like that. They're interrupted at night by the glare of fire from the crematoria, the factory chimney stacks and whatnot. So all of that, is there. And I think, it's not particularly sophisticated or subtle, right? It's saying anyone whose life where you enjoy some kind of aspect of material comfort, you have a garden and a family, maybe a large garden and a family, maybe with a swimming pool and a nice house, and maybe you have, staff or something like that. Anyone with any kind of modicum of material middle-class comfort is living next to some unspeakable horror, and it's all off-screen, right? Let me finish, right? So the unspeakable horror off screen is left kind of completely blanched out. It could be anything, right? It could be any kind of atrocity. It could be, kind of a lithium mine in Congo. It could be like a terrible global warming thing. It could be deforestation. Anything which occupies the kind of modern image of some terrible atrocity that's happening next to your kind of isolated oasis of middle-class comfort, and that should induce feelings of guilt in you. It's a repulsively manipulative film.
I didn't find that at all. I think that's a reach, and I think maybe it's a projection of your own guilty conscience that you are standing by, and so you feel oppressed by this
touché
film telling you, hey, you should care. It's actually not telling you should care at all. It doesn't do that at all.
Is exactly what it's doing.
I think the film is very good. I think it's a very good film. I don't think it's an excellent film, but I think it's a very good film. I think it's very skillfully done in its sound design in particular, as I said.
Oh my
visually
God, the sound design.
But that's what the film's about. Like it's not a plot film. It's not something which is kind of entertaining or tells a story, right, about someone. I mean, Hearst's progression through the ranks is relatively minimal.
Visual,
it's not a whole story.
The intercutting the scenes with the one of the Polish servant girls from the Hoss house who is distributing kind of fruit for the incarcerated laborers is kind of cut through with black and white, so it's not in the usual colors. It's so crude. There is nothing about that is artistic or effective, Alex.
I think it was quite successful in doing that. What it tries to do is
I always thought you had bad taste in movies.
It tries to be it's kind of like a visual poem in that regard. And whether visual and oral poem, and if that's not your thing, that's entirely fine. I think that's entirely acceptable. I think it's the point about Banality of Evil is handled in a way which is so obvious that it's almost hard to make a commentary on it because it's front and center. It is what the film's about. It doesn't even make a commentary on the banality of evil. It just depicts it. I think maybe it's not so interesting because it's, I think it would have been more interesting, for example, to do that a little bit more tangentially rather than kind of head on. But I've also think it's an original film. I haven't seen a film very much like this.
It's original, you know, it's original in the kind of the basic premise. Like I say, it's pivoting away from the suffering of the Jews or stand in for the Jews and asking us to consider ourselves, our own kind of guiltiness. I mean, basically, the message of the film is this, right? Aren't we all, in a way, camp commandants outside of Auschwitz, where you can put in any kind of anything you want in Auschwitz, and everyone is kind of implicated in the guilt? We're all Nazis.
I think that's a complete reach. I think, you know,
not at all. It is a British director from the liberal middle classes, the Guardian reading middle classes. It is the purest distillation of PMC horseshit in cinema that you can imagine. And I don't care, you know, I know that might irritate some of our listeners.
All filmmakers are PMC. What are you talking about? All filmmakers are PMC by definition.
No, successful film, not necessarily, but successful filmmakers rise above it. This is North London horse shit. It's designed for Guardian readers to feel good about themselves by wallowing in their own moral filth and guilt.
Look, so speaking as the North London correspondent of the podcast, I feel like I can
you
can
don't
contribute.
Live in North London. That's not true. North London North- is Jeremy Corbyn's constituency. It doesn't mean north of the river.
I mean, you're Phil. I think you're falling into a well-constructed stereotype that you have crafted for yourself. And I don't think you're going to win many people over with that.
Not at all.
No, I think there is something in what Phil's saying here, which is like, what is the message of the film? Because as much as you can say, like, this is a film that doesn't have narrative, that has like all of these, you know, is a visual poem or whatever you, however you might want to put it. Clearly it's about an important subject, capital I, capital S. It leaves you with a message. I think that's definitely true. And this is why I was trying to, and again, not to be a kind of contrarian, but is this film really about the Holocaust? Because it's not shown. I mean, you could say like, the Holocaust is too big a thing really to represent on film. I made this point or asked this question around like Napoleon and the French Revolution. How do you represent on film something like that? Maybe you need to do something like Shoah, and you know, if you've got 9.5 hours to tell that story, maybe you can, but in a kind of, you know, 1-2 hour feature film, that's very tricky. Because I guess my sort of it seemed like the it's a more general message. I think Phil is right about that. It is about the proximity to suffering. It's almost like gated communities worldwide. Like that is what it's about, that kind of separation and the kind of proximity to something bad that's happening that ultimately should trouble and undermine your kind of your settled opinions or your kind of your own way of looking at your life. It is trying to tell that, I think, that moral lesson rather than one about the Holocaust specifically because of the way it's framed. I mean,
it's not really about the banality of evil, I think, in fact, because Hannah Arendt's point isn't about living a nice kind of comfortable life alongside suffering. Her point is about the way in which certain kinds of state administrative machinery and apparatus works and the motivations of people, you know, the motivations of people in massive bureaucracies, abstract bureaucracies with entirely kind of non-ideological motives for career advancement. And some of that is in the film, right? But it's not really about kind of internal machinations of bureaucracy, right? It's about living a kind of a very ordinary upper middle class life next to Auschwitz. And so I don't really think it's about the banality of evil at all.
It's more maybe about the banality of indifference, like, or the something like, because that's what the main, like, the aside from Hearst himself, like his family, they're, you know, not shown to be in the meetings with bureaucrats talking about the kind of efficiency of different styles of gas chambers. I mean, of, you know, why would his children and his wife be in those meetings? But they are, you know, they are forced
to face...
They're
important characters in the film. Yeah.
But they're forced to face away from the wall, which even the mother of the main female character is like, you know, is that the wall of the camp? And she's like, oh yeah, change the subject, basically. So there is, I think that's why it's a bit wider, because it is it's about indifference rather than evil, because it is more, I think, about the family life and that kind of proximity to evil than the way that, you know, as you said, Phil, like these bureaucratic decisions just come to, like, you know, talking about people like human beings here, but they're just numbers on a page, and it's, you know, carbon copy to this person and signed off, and that's how the machine gets things, you know, that's the sort of reason that leads to the Holocaust reason.
So I want to say, like, I do, you know, I don't think the Holocaust, you know, that kind of old cliche, the Holocaust can't kind of be captured on film or something. I don't think that's true. And I think films like The Pianist and The Edges of the Lord, they do a very good job, in fact, of doing that. But, you know, notwithstanding that, and I didn't want to really make it about the PMC, but I had a very strong reaction to this film because I genuinely found it revolting in its implications and the kind of morality that it was trying to impose on the viewer. Now, Alex thinks I'm projecting, you know, and obviously it's possible, maybe I am. But I do want to convince the listener or the viewer that this is an authentic reaction on my part. I really, really hated this film. And I'm not just saying it to make points about the PMC, because as we all know, that's George's job, not mine.
We have to move on. I have, just to reiterate, I didn't have that impression of the film at all. Maybe it's because I don't have to live and work with British or Anglo liberals, and therefore that notion that there might be someone going, "Hey, you should feel bad about," like, it didn't even enter my mind.
Yeah, you're just living in your gated community in Sao Paulo, Brazil, watching me and Phil suffer.
Well, exactly, you're the one to feel guilty about it, whereas I don't. So anyway,
well, maybe
I think
Alex is a boy from Brazil.
To move on to the discourse around the film, just specifically on the film, one of my most favorite, which is to say hated, movie reviewers, Richard Brody, was outraged that, in fact, very contrary to what we've been discussing, there's only banality and no evil. He said, there's no room for rabidness in this movie, no ideological talk or overt hatred. So he needed to be told, hey, the Nazis are bad, and he thought this was far too neutral. He is the guy who wants to be told what to think by films. His movie reviews are often seized on the fact that what is being depicted is being endorsed or being reified in some way. And so anyway, it's interesting because it presents the radically different or alternate interpretation to what Phil's been saying. He just felt like, hey man, I need to be told the Nazis are bad. I can't believe this isn't saying this is bad. I think it's worth noting and hinting to that. One other point which someone made, which is that, you know, with regard to the banality of evil, that to portray Hirst as a bureaucrat, you know, just a kind of cold gray man, is wrong because he's more of a petty criminal, a thug, a gangster. And I think that's maybe interesting. I don't know if we maybe want to discuss that, but I just want to gesture at that because that would be an alternative interpretation of a film or a course for a film which focuses on the Nazis and the banality of evil, but in a rather different way, because it isn't the banality of evil story of the kind of cold bureaucrat just social climbing and in doing so massacring 6 million people. No, it's actually they're much more thuggish. Anyway, that's a whole different discussion. I don't want to get onto that. Mm. What I do want to get onto, though, in terms of the commentary of the film, I don't think we have to rehash the discussion around Jonathan Glazer's Oscar acceptance speech. He got himself into some trouble because he said he refuted his Jewishness, which is not what refute means. He means he rejected the use of his Jewishness for in support of the war. And of course, everybody who would have agreed with him anyway, or was again, you know, agreed with every, you know, everyone who defends Israel defended him. Everyone who thinks Israel is the worst thing in the world was against him. And I think that is just the usual kind of culture war stuff, which is not that interesting. But what do we think about some of the other commentary, which makes this point? And I've in the show notes, you'll see some examples, which I put in from Naomi Klein in The Guardian, for example, or Julia Jakes in Navarra, basically that a genocide is being committed in full view now in Gaza, and we are just standing by. And this film is, well, this is a review, you know, these are reviews of this film. So obviously it's putting it in that context of you are idly standing by what happens, right? Which is, I guess, to Phil's point. But again, this is the discourse around it. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's, so just a shout out to Maren Tom, Bungacast regular, who in a very good piece in Cafe American, basically, and I think this point is like right in the kind of center of this kind of discourse, is that this is a contemporary film that is already an anachronism. So it's basically, evil isn't banal anymore, like in, you know, post October the 7th, it's now kind of the bureaucrats of old are replaced by the kind of the live action of now. So her case would be that in a weird way, October the 7th kind of dated the film or put it in a kind of different historical moment where the concern was about banality, but now it seems a lot more, a lot more kind of hot-blooded, the commentary on things. Certainly, I mean, yeah, I think you have to take any director's commentary on their own films with a pinch of salt. They are there to tell visual stories. They are not there to make any political pronouncements. So I think, I don't know, I might be being a bit too, having a bit too much of a hard line on this, but I basically, if you don't change your opinion of a film, depending on what the director says. You can basically ignore all of their speeches, all of their descriptions of the film. Just like with Alex Garland, I did make this point with Civil War, like you can only make it worse by reading what he writes or listening to what he says. So, I mean, but what is clear is that there has been, you know, I think Phil made this point earlier, like what does explain why this film has been so discussed and so like talked about, because it doesn't seem to be its artistic merits. It, you know, straightforwardly gives people the chance to talk about what they wanted to talk about anyway, which is Israel-Palestine. This is obviously not a film about Israel-Palestine. It's a film about a related matter, you might put it, but obviously everybody has interpreted it through that lens, leading to, yeah, I think, Alex, you're probably about right. A lot of culture wars, people talking past each other or just, you know, not really wanting to have a conversation.
I think, I mean, I would go a bit further, I think, in that it's not just, you know, I think it's also possible to, you know, to write off any hotly contested dispute, particularly in the realm of culture or cultural kind of debates that are adjacent to political issues of the day, to write it off as culture wars because, you know, it's all heat and no light. And I think it's a bit more than that in this case, because I think what's happening is it marks a moment when Israel can no longer legitimate itself by reference to the suffering of the Holocaust. And that's significant, I think. And Jonathan Glazer standing up there and saying what he did and claiming, you know, that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide with the authority of somebody who's been awarded an Oscar for a film which is about the genocide of the Jews, that seems to me to be an important shift, as well as the fact that this film, like I say, is a shift away from inviting the viewer to see the film from the viewpoint of the victims, instead to see it from the viewpoint of the perpetrators in a very specific context, you know, kind of senior ranking administrators rather than the people involved in face-to-face killing. So I think it's, you know, it's not just kind of culture wars effluvia. I think it does mark an important historic point, which is the way in which Israel is no longer, it's lost a lot of legitimacy internationally. It can't claim the legitimacy of victimhood in the way that it could in the past. And also that this isn't just something, you know, it's also Jews abroad who might or might not sympathize with Israel generally are withdrawing their support for what Israel is doing in Gaza, for, you know, their opposition to it. Well, and that's an important moment, and this is being registered culturally, I think, in what's happening around the film. But also,
the contrast, so let me just make a point on that quickly. The contrast with Schindler's List is apposite, because that, think, as Naomi Klein pointed out, that film came out at a moment of unprecedented mainstream visibility for Jews in America, and just kind of consensus around the Jewish community, where they weren't yet hated for the connection with Israel, and there was just general support for Israel. And this comes out at precisely the opposite moment, where that is kind of very much breaking down, particularly the younger generation, a point which we've discussed on recent podcasts.
Yeah, so it's also the end of the era of humanitarian intervention as well, right? I mean, I think that's part of it as well. Schindler's List becomes a kind of a cultural backdrop to the era of humanitarian intervention, which is the era of unipolarity, and we're living in the era in which unipolarity has come to an end. That makes military intervention of the old kind very difficult. And also the claim, you know, the kind of the ultimate backstop to the era of humanitarian military intervention is the suffering of the Jews as the historic exemplar that legitimates all military interventions across the 1990s. And so, now that's being pulled away It's a very different moment. This is the movie that registers that.
Well, is the film then completely of its time in that you don't need to anymore, because victimhood is so, I don't know, I think you might make this case feel so central to the way that states legitimize themselves, or maybe this is something which is being realized now. Is it a film of its moment in that it doesn't need to represent a specific victim because we already take that for granted in a way? I mean, because that is one, you know, that is, I think it probably is fairly unusual amongst Holocaust films in that you don't see the victims directly. So I wonder if there is some connection. I might be kind of completely overreaching here, but like,
no, I think we don't anymore
need to represent a specific individual. And in fact, it's better.
It's not concrete. Yeah, it's not concrete suffering. So it's not the Jews for being Jewish, or homosexuals for being homosexual, Tutsis for being Tutsi, or Bosnian Muslims for being Bosnian Muslim, right? It's just this generic horror, which you don't see, and which you're invited to reflect and contemplate on the indifference of those who live literally alongside it. And that seems to me to be an important cultural moment, which is not just kind of the effluvia of right-wing commentators booing Jonathan Glazer at the Oscars, but something kind of deeper in terms of the shifting structure, which is very hard to discern, I think, unless you think of it culturally. It'd be very hard to see this unless you think of what's happening culturally here. So
one last point to discuss. The film finishes, or almost finishes. It's kind of it's a quick flash forward, which then and then the film goes back to Rudolf Höss, and as he's leaving a kind of big gala ball of Nazis Nazi cocktail party, which he's like not really bothered to be at because he's thinking of work. There's actually one joke in the film, only one joke, which is while he's at this ball, he's thinking about the big salon room, and he's thinking, man, it'd be so hard to fill this place with gas. Which is a dark but quite a funny joke. The fast forward to the Auschwitz Museum, where the cleaners come in and there's the window display of all the shoes collected and various other things left behind by the victims. And, you know, that's very deliberate, right? It's very pointed. It's very in your face that there's this flash forward to the Auschwitz Museum, but it's also, you know, done in a fairly muted way, right? So it's not going, oh my God, look at something happen. It's not showing loads of tourists going into the Auschwitz Museum. It's just showing the cleaners coming in, and it's a banal, very banal scene, right? So there's the continuity of banality there. But what do we think he's saying? Why does he choose to show that? Is he making a commentary, perhaps, on what to do about Auschwitz, which continues to be a controversial topic, whether to maintain, to let it rot, or to tear it down?
Yeah, and there's another, particularly for listeners who might not have seen the film. So it goes from the main character walking down some stairs, and then it kind of zooms forward in time. And you don't really know if it's in his head. Is he seeing this happening? That's one interpretation. I don't think it probably is what is happening to the cleaners cleaning the glass cases where you have all the shoes kind of piled up from people who were on their way into the gas chambers, which is, you know, simultaneously a very banal act. And then through that pane of glass, you see something which, when you put it into context, is completely shocking. But there is another bit, as I was saying, which is that he starts retching. So it's not really clear why. And he just kind of starts retching, and like, you think he's kind of going to throw up on the floor as he gets to the bottom of the stairs. And I found this very unsatisfying. I guess halfway through the film, I'd started to think, how is this going to finish? There's no clear direction it's going. I actually thought it would kind of be worse, but actually in retrospect, it might have been better if there was some kind of clear moral lesson of some sort, but it isn't. I mean, does he know? Does he feel like he knows at one level that this is evil and he's coughing it up, and that allows him to keep going and keep his career on an upward trajectory? It's very unclear what Glazer's actually trying to do there, but it did leave me just thinking, oh, that's not an ending. That's the problem with these kind of films. Like, how do you wrap it up in a way that feels satisfying? It's basically impossible.
Well, as it happens, I think it's good for it not to be satisfying. I mean, that it doesn't seek to give the viewer a sense of closure, satisfaction. I think that's fine. Though I do think I take your point about him being sick. It's like all the repression of the horror he's involved in. Yeah. It kind of comes up with him. Now, as to the question of Auschwitz, because I think that's, I don't know if you share this reading, but I do think he's asking a question there. My personal take is, and I'm not sure if Glazer's doing this through the movie, but because, you know, he doesn't show tourists visiting Auschwitz, for example. My personal feelings on the matter is that it should be left to rot. I think tearing it down sends the wrong message of kind of erasing the past, but I also think maintaining it, there's something perverse about that. It makes the museum prone to a certain Disneylandification. All the things that have been that there is to document about the experience has been documented, and there's no real human value, I think, to maintaining it as a museum. So that's my take, and I feel that anyway. This is kind of an opinion I've held for a long time. Seeing the film did prompt me to think about it again, and to think about whether the film is kind of dialoguing with that notion that there is maybe something perverse in the banality of these cleaners coming in and just maintaining this place. Like, what are you doing? What is this for?
I hadn't quite thought of the flash forward in time in that way. And it's an interesting question, Alex. I think perhaps I'll have to think about it a bit more, but I thought it was an interesting, because it cuts away from them and goes back to him wandering down the stairs back in the 1940s after having flash forwarded to the present. And I thought that was an interesting, you know, that it was an interesting juxtaposition. And maybe the only kind of intellectually interesting part of the film was that, in fact, was putting together these two scenes at different points in time around the same place. So I don't have any, I suppose I think it's worth maintaining. I think it'd be worth maintaining Auschwitz, particularly as the Holocaust completely fades from living memory, and in an era in which is so awash with conspiracy theory stupidity and YouTube autodidacticism, I think actually retaining the physical legacy of such crucial aspects of the nadir of the 20th century, I think, is historically justified. So for that reason, I think it should be kept as a museum, and not, it doesn't have to be Disneyfied. I've never been myself, so I can't comment, but I think it's worth keeping.
Yeah, I mean, I have been, and I remember more than seeing it, the train journey away from it, just like nothing, not saying anything, not talking about it. There's nothing to say. I think it was a very powerful thing, and, you know, for that reason, if it were to be left to disintegrate or torn down, you know, the people wouldn't have that. But just on the meaning of this, like, why does he finish this way? I think if there had been like tourists coming in to see the exhibits in the Auschwitz museum, it would have, I guess it makes me think, is he kind of being self-critical in a way, like, this is what I'm doing, you know, I'm the glazer, you know, to go back to that idea, cleaning the glass, and this is, you know, you as the viewer, what are you doing in this experience? You're looking at this suffering. You're looking at the suffering that I'm presenting. So either he's the museum, or he's the person who's cleaning the glass, just so that you as the viewer can look through it to see the suffering there. And so he's basically sort of saying, maybe, you know, I'm complicit in this voyeuristic exercise, perhaps. Although that might be, you know, reading way too much into it. But I think it was, you know, that was, I think I'd probably agree with Phil that it was the one point of the film where I was like, oh, there could be something interesting happening here. But it didn't leave me sort of after viewing it with a kind of, like being in Auschwitz, like, or coming back from Auschwitz on the train, like a feeling of like deep contemplation, and I, you know, I need to think about this. Instead, it was a bit like, oh, yeah, not going to get that kind of time of an hour and a half watching that back, unfortunately. So,
Well, we obviously differ on that. I didn't come away thinking it was spectacular, as I said. In fact, the film left me relatively quickly, though I know, you know, there are people who were very impacted by it. I didn't find it so much, but I did find it a stunning kind of visual and oral piece of work. So that was, that's my vibe on it. Guys, well, we have somewhat inadvertently done a bit of a month of May 2024 on the horrors of the 20th century, the mid 20th century, because you might want to check out an episode which came out 4 weeks ago, Alex Gurevich talking to his father, the renowned political scientist, Peter Gurevich, about his astounding family history, Mensheviks in the USSR, their escape from the USSR, escape from Berlin, escape from Paris, etc. So there's that's, I would highly recommend that. It's a fascinating story. You should also check out, obviously, if you're interested in contemporary questions of Israel and responses to it, or discussion on Palestine campus protests, which came out 2 weeks ago. That is a free episode. We also discussed Stalin, the biography of Stalin done by Isaac Deutscher. Phil introduced that to us in the Reading Club that came out last week. And then in film, we had Civil War last week, which you might want to check out. Really enjoyed doing that. This has been a rare, actually, back-to-back film film episodes that we've put out. We enjoy doing this anyway. It's not a plan to become a film podcast, but do let us know if there are some films you think we should be discussing and debating on here. And then coming up, we have Eva Illouz talking about, cold intimacies, emotional capitalism, as well as contemporary matters of Israel, the rightward drift of Israeli politics, Israeli populism. And we also have Sam Chris, as I mentioned. We have Simon Reynolds, music journalist, talking about Retromania and Futuremania. So I'm very excited to be doing that. So if all this sounds good, tell your friends. Tell your friends to join up. Come along. We are always wanting to carry on this debate, so the more the merrier. Share this episode if you'd like. And we will be with you again very soon, in a matter of days. We look forward to talking then. Catch you later.